This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The business story of this Wednesday is one of supply and demand. Fewer flights, fewer seats, higher prices for those seats. Airline profits are the corporate bright spot today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At AllyBank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 20th of October today, and we can safely call today's profit news from the airline industry counterintuitive. The economic climate for the rest of us is still fairly blah, but the skies are way friendlier for the major U.S. carriers. Today, Delta, U.S. Airways, and American Airlines reported strong earnings for the summer travel season. American posted its first profit in 2 years, in point of fact. United shares took off as well in anticipation of its earnings announcement tomorrow. And the big airlines are optimistic about the rest of the year as well, never mind rising fuel prices. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
If you've done any flying at all lately, you've almost certainly had to arm wrestle your seatmate for some room.
You're seeing load factors, the percentage of a plane that's filled by revenue-paying passengers, above 85%, which is unprecedented.
Teal Group airline analyst Richard Abulafia says the carriers have cut excess capacity by grounding planes so they can fill seats on every flight. That tight discipline has seen them through the toughest times. Now they're seeing higher-paying business travelers flying more. And what Abulafia calls clever pricing for everything from baggage to blankets has produced windfall revenue. But he concedes the industry's recent consolidation from six major carriers to four has allowed that kind of clever pricing.
There's no question that getting airlines out of the mix definitely helps pricing power. You're going to have some markets which just have fewer players serving them than before.
We'll prove we're not just building a bigger airline, we're building a better one.
It may be no small irony that Delta's new ad campaign features the slogan, "Keep Climbing." At the consulting firm Airline Forecasts, Vaughn Cordell says that's what fares are bound to do.
Delta, for instance, has a new target 10 to 12% operating margin. That means they've got to raise fares.
Independent aviation consultant Bob Mann sees some benefits, too. He says a stronger air transportation system should avert cutbacks that have threatened some destinations.
If you're a small community who really relies on air service to connect yourself to the network, the likelihood is you'll continue to have that service at convenient times and frequencies.
The caveat being, it just may cost more. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Over in the UK today, the news was all budget deficit all the time. This morning, the Brits became the first major economy to launch a big deficit reduction program. The government unveiled cuts of more than $130 billion, 500,000 public sector jobs, proportionally way deeper than anything that's even being talked about over here. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Today is the day when Britain steps back from the brink. When we confront.
In a stormy House of Commons, the finance chief, George Osborne, laid out the deepest budget cuts for more than half a century. He said they're needed so that Britain's public debt doesn't spiral out of control.
And that we do not saddle our children with the interest on the interest on the interest of the debts that we were not prepared ourselves to pay.
At about 10% of GDP, Britain's deficit is a bit smaller than America's. But the cuts are roughly four times tougher than anything the US is even contemplating. A total of $28 billion will be stripped from Britain's welfare budget, Around 490,000 public sector posts will go. That, by the way, is the equivalent of 2.5 million jobs in the US. Keith Fletcher is a local government worker, and he's furious.
I think the public sector are being made to pay the price of the banking sector's mistakes in the past.
Defending the cuts in a noisy House of Commons, Prime Minister David Cameron made no apology for the loss of public jobs.
If we don't tackle the deficit, every job in this country is at threat. That's the point.
The government says that without this drastic action, Britain could face the same kind of debt crisis as Greece and Ireland. But some independent analysts say the cuts are a massive gamble, since public spending now accounts for almost half the British economy. Martin Wolfe is the chief economics commentator of the Financial Times.
A retrenchment on this scale this quickly looks excessive, is likely to have a very negative effect on growth, and that will mean that the actual fiscal deficit won't improve as much as they think.
If the economy actually contracts, the deficit could worsen. The government hopes the private sector will come to the rescue and create hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Many other countries with big deficits, like the US, will be watching Britain to see what happens next. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you use Microsoft Office at work, like, yeah, almost all of us, you probably noticed there are some applications you use a lot, like Outlook and Word, and some you use less, like Excel or maybe PowerPoint. Either way, your company pays license fees for all of them, because that's the way Microsoft does business, right? You buy the whole bundle or you buy nothing at all. New York City has managed to work out a different deal today, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
New York City used to have more than 40 separate licensing agreements with Microsoft, and they were all for the whole suite of software products. Now the city will have just one contract, and it'll pay different rates for different employees. New York says the deal will save around $50 million over 5 years. Carol Post is the city's commissioner in charge of IT.
The city and Microsoft recognize that different users use different tools, and we've priced that accordingly.
So the license for the assistant who just uses Outlook will be cheaper than the license for the commissioner who needs Outlook and PowerPoint and Excel and Word. Rob Helm is an analyst at Directions on Microsoft, an independent research firm.
It opens up a bit of a crack in Microsoft's one-size-fits-all pricing strategy for large organizations, and it could lead to other large customers to ask for similar deals.
Deals Microsoft may have to agree to in order to compete against companies like Google for big government contracts. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Down hard one day, up sharply the next. Ain't Wall Street great? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big foreclosure news of the day is that there really isn't any. Everybody's still trying to digest what might happen next in this whole thing, whether banks are going to be forced to take back some or maybe all of the mortgage bonds they packaged up and sold off in the run-up to the credit crisis. Also, what to do about the foreclosures that have been stopped. Bank of America said the other day it's going to get going with some of its foreclosures again after a brief nationwide pause. Tom Dart, the sheriff in Cook County, Illinois, and as such the person responsible for evicting people who've been foreclosed on, isn't having any of it. Yesterday he said he's not going to throw anybody out of their homes until the banks can prove to him the foreclosures are legitimate. Sheriff, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
About how many foreclosure files do you have sitting in your office right now that you're just holding on to?
Oh, about 1,500.
And you just don't believe that the documentary requirements have been met for those by the banks?
You know, the thing that's been interesting about this, a couple years ago, we stopped the foreclosure proceedings here in Cook County because it was absolutely clear that the banks were not notifying people that were physically in the houses they were wanting me to empty out. This latest cessation is because the banks themselves have come forward and told us that in their haste to get through these foreclosures have done things in a way where they aren't completely sure that it was done properly. And that's where I find myself scratching my head, because all I'm asking is just send me an affidavit that you're willing to put your name on saying that these foreclosures that you have given me, that you've done them properly. If you've done that, I'm fine. I'll move ahead. But just let me know that they're legal, please.
Yeah, you've singled out Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and GMAC, Ally Financial. Have you heard from them since you announced this stoppage?
I believe our attorneys have had some conversations with them. You know, they obviously aren't happy with me, but when I've done this in the past, the banks have not been terribly thrilled with me either.
I don't imagine you're actually out there doing these foreclosures and evictions, but your deputies must come back and tell you stories about putting people out.
Unfortunately, I do a lot of the evictions myself. I have been at the door. I have been in these people's living rooms. And I'll never forget the one family I went in. They were literally having their dinner, and they were all sitting around. There was three little kids, a mother and a father. And then all of a sudden, here I am standing next to seven deputies all dressed in black with battering rams in their living room. The children are crying, and I'm sitting down with these people, and they're showing me paperwork after paperwork, showing they've paid all their bills, they paid everything. That's where we finally, 2 years ago, got to the point where we just stopped. It was just, the injustice was unbelievable.
So what's next?
Well, my strong hope is that the banks will let me know that they have done a thorough analysis in all the cases and all the files that they have sent toward my office. There's no legal concerns, in which case I can go ahead and resume the proper foreclosures. But one of the things that we did when all this thing exploded over 2 years ago is I hired a social worker. Now, as opposed to me sitting with the families trying to work out options, I now have a social worker who's out there trying to get people in substitute housing and trying to do it in a way that I believe has a little bit of humanity attached to it.
Tom Dart, the sheriff of Cook County, Illinois. Sheriff, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The most important number in your economic life isn't necessarily your Social Security number or your phone number at the office. It's your credit score. Once limited to decisions about whether or not you got a mortgage or a car loan, it's increasingly being used by employers in hiring and promotion decisions. Today, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission decided it was about time to start looking at establishing a national policy for the use of that number. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The EEOC says there's been an uptick in businesses using credit checks to help figure out whether to hire or keep an employee. Now more than half of all U.S. companies do. Michael Eastman with the Chamber of Commerce says they only screen for a small minority of job categories.
And it could be for employees that have direct access to client or company cash. It could be those with access to controlled substances or other sensitive information such as trade secrets.
But with 10% unemployment and record home foreclosures, are credit checks fair? At today's hearing, Chi-Chi Wu of the National Consumer Law Center told the commission they're not.
The worker who loses her job is likely to fall behind on her bills because of lack of income. She can't rebuild her credit history if she can't get a job, and she can't get a job if she's got bad credit.
For 10 years, consultant Deanna Keels watched the growth in employee credit checks as she helped recruit executives for companies like Home Depot and Koch Industries.
If a person didn't have a lot of debt, they saw that as a reflection of their integrity and their ability to pay and responsibility and such.
But Keels got disgusted with the discrimination she saw in the reviews. This year, she quit and started helping people restore their credit.
You have people whose credit has been perfect who are now struggling, and so their credit is going downhill. And if you're using it as a reflection of responsibility or integrity, that's not necessarily a true picture.
Congress is considering a ban on credit checks for employees. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials climbed 129 points today, more than 1%, ended at 11,107. The Nasdaq rose 20 points, about 0.8%, closed at 2457. The S&P 500 lifted 12 points, just over 1%, finished at 1178. Shares of American Airlines soared more than 12% higher. Delta roared more than 10% higher. U.S. Airways flew more than 7% up on stronger earnings of its own. Of course, all those airplanes need planes to fly. All those airlines, rather, need planes to fly. Demand for 737s and the like landed Boeing more than $800 million in quarterly profit. Shares lofted more than 3% today. Wells Fargo saw profits rise nearly 20%. Investors sent shares galloping more than 4% higher. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Rain, snow, La Nina. The National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center releases its U.S. winter outlook. And bankers give lessons in classrooms around the country on the credit facts of life. It's the American Bankers Association's Get Smart About Credit Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's a couple of weeks yet till Election Day, which means it's a couple of weeks yet until we'll know the exact impact of last spring's Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance. That's the one that said companies and unions can spend as much as they want on pretty much whatever they want. The ruling is generally thought to have been to businesses' advantage. Commentator Robert Reich says it's not necessarily so.
Businesses should be worried about the hundreds of millions of secret dollars now going into political campaigns. It's one thing when you know what your competitors are doing politically because they have to disclose it. You can then neutralize their donations by at least matching them or doing them one better. But when you don't know what they're up to, you're in trouble. What if your competitor's money gets some judges elected? You could end up more vulnerable to antitrust claims from a competitor, or lawsuits alleging patent infringement, or charges you interfered in a contractual relationship. What if your competitors get a governor elected? You could lose a state contract that's quietly transferred to one of them, or lose out to them on battles over eminent domain, or rights to air or water, or on the benefits of where and who highways to be constructed. It could be even worse if your competitors get members of Congress elected. They could end up with tax breaks that are far more valuable to them than to you, or subsidies or earmarks that improve their competitive position at your expense. Of course, political secrecy puts your competitors in the same boat. They don't know who you're supporting and by how much, so they have no way to counter what you're doing politically. The result is that you and they have to spend even more. And this is exactly what the lobbyists, political operatives, and media buyers behind the secrecy want. It gives them more power to extort your company's money by saying, in effect, if you don't pay up, you'll be at a competitive disadvantage. In other words, secret corporate donations are not only bad for democracy, they're bad for business. They only intensify the competitive arms race in corporate political donations that's been escalating for years. It's a zero-sum game that helps no one, not you, not your competitors, not even politicians who just have to raise even more money. The only winners are the intermediaries who make out like bandits.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His new book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week in his regular spot, David Frum is going to be here. In the meanwhile, take a second to send along your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Here, by the way, is today's update on the wider health of the economy. The Federal Reserve came out with its beige book this morning, so named because the cover is, in fact, beige. It's the Fed's once every 6 weeks look at the economy on a regional basis. Growth, yes, but sluggish and uneven is the big takeaway. Next time we're going to hear from the Fed is going to be after their interest rate meeting. That happens the day after Election Day. Retirement, as we used to know it, isn't really around anymore. Forget the gold watch and a guaranteed pension. People are working longer. Not because they want to, although some do. Mostly, it's because after 3 years of recession, they have to work. Pensions and retirement accounts just aren't what they used to be. There is a brighter side, though. When people do finally decide to slow down, they've got some more choices, as Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
So what does a can of Coke have to do with retirement? Just ask Professor Andrew Carl from George Mason University. He says baby boomers are changing the retirement business the way they change the soda business.
We've got cherry Coke, vanilla Coke, Coke with lime. They wanted the flavors of Coke that would make them happy.
And he says that's what you now see in retirement living. More variety, like places for poets, for art lovers, for ethnic groups, even nudists. Carl says specialized retirement communities will make up a third of the market in the next decade or so. And the biggest growth in that type of housing is on college campuses. Brunch is underway at Belmont Village in Los Angeles. The Harpist is warming up as waiters go over the menu.
Well, did you see our special as you walked in? Did you see all those choices?
Belmont is about a mile from UCLA. About a third of the residents are UCLA alums or retired faculty. That's by design, since UCLA has a partnership with the retirement home. The college provides faculty for talks, and UCLA members will get housing priority if Belmont is ever full. Lori Nussbaum works at Belmont. She says there's a natural fit between a college campus and a retirement center.
When a person is young and in college and they're enjoying the learning experience, plus there's the camaraderie of feeling like you're with other people who share their connection to the university.
More than 60 other colleges have retirement communities near campus, including University of Michigan, Ithaca College, and Stanford. But sharing that old college camaraderie doesn't come cheap. Some communities can cost more than $2,000 a month. A one-bedroom apartment at Belmont is a lot more expensive, about $5,000 a month. But that includes access to the gym, trainers, transportation, field trips, and meals. And that's why 88-year-old Katie Kolodziejski moved in a year ago.
I don't have to think about food. I don't have to buy it. I don't have to fix it. And I don't have to clean it up.
Kolodziejski loves the food, but what she loves more is the chance to revisit her former life. She spent 40 years at UCLA as a professor, so now being close to campus means she can mentor students. And Professor Carl says that's why colleges partner with retirement centers.
What we want are active, intellectually stimulating, and intergenerational environments, and that's basically a college campus. Where it's good for the universities is the opportunity to, frankly, recycle old customers.
Carl says it could help spur donations. Last year, private giving to colleges dropped by 12%. One reason? Older folks don't feel a connection anymore, and the recession hasn't helped. But Kolodziejski says her bond has grown since living here.
I would also say the connection with the university supplied a lot of synapse-snapping opportunities besides volunteering, but it keeps me moving upstairs.
And she says that's important for an 88-year-old retiree who doesn't want to slow down just yet. I'm Nancy Fargali for Marketplace.
Since the economy first started going backward 3 years ago, clothing boutiques, restaurants, electronics stores, retailers of every kind have closed up and moved out. But if you take a chilly real estate market, top it with recession cravings and a self-serve obsession, you got yourself a business. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports now on the surprising rise of frozen yogurt.
At a Froyo Life yogurt shop in Los Angeles, 27-year-old Jessica Robinson is making her ritual late afternoon visit.
I got pumpkin and cake batter frozen yogurt with Cinnamon Toast Crunch on top. And it's a definite good choice.
And when it comes to frozen yogurt, Robinson is all about choice.
I love Froyo Life. I come here a lot. I do love 21 Choices, but I haven't been in a while because it's kind of far away. I go to a place called Menchie's also, which is out in Santa Clarita. I go to a place called Yogurtlicious also. I guess I'm pretty passionate about it.
And the way the industry's been growing, it's going to need all of the Jessica Robinsons it can get. There are now around 22,000 frozen yogurt stores in the U.S. Pinkberry touched off a craze in 2005. Then things slowed down, but yogurt's getting a second wind. Hospitality consultant James Sinclair says entrepreneurs are flocking to Froyo because, unlike most businesses,
the cost of entry is very quick. The build-out is quick and cheap. The lack of skill set you need to become a frozen yogurt operator, again, ties into the ease of entry into this market.
Sinclair says it can cost less than $10,000 to open a frozen yogurt shop. And with so many vacant storefronts, landlords are eager for the business.
You can throw in a frozen yogurt store. They'll sign a one-year lease. For a landlord, they're able to have a tenant while they ride out this market.
Sinclair's business partner Jim Husted says that has spawned a frozen yogurt bubble.
If you're successful in the location, that means that three others are coming. It doesn't mean that you've taken over the market and everyone's scared to be there because you're going to beat them. So it's, oh my God, they're doing great. Let's open up three right next to them.
One of the fastest growing chains is Red Mango. Dan Kim is the founder and CEO.
Yeah, we have a lot of interest from franchisees and developers who want to get into the business. And it's been a lot stronger this year than it was, say, in 2008, 2009.
After closing stores during the recession, Red Mango is launching new locations all over the country. But Kim says they're tweaking the model for today's yogurt enthusiast, like at the original Red Mango near UCLA in West Los Angeles.
This actually started as a full-serve store back in 2007, and earlier this year we converted it to a self-serve store.
Customers get their own yogurt. Top it.
You know what's really good, actually, with the pumpkin spice is the graham cracker crumbs and the dark chocolate chips.
And weigh it.
14 ounces of yogurt.
Self-serve is a down economy dream, says Darren Tristano with food industry research firm Technomic.
You get greater control in the consumer's hands, which is something that we all want because we have a lot of anxiety about reduced spending and about what's going on in the economy.
And we like to feed our anxiety dessert. Tristano says people eat sweets more often when the economy is bad. He thinks the frozen yogurt craze is far from over.
We think this trend is going to continue because it's a very high demand. We believe it's going to start to integrate more into full-service restaurants. One of the big fears is, what if McDonald's starts to serve frozen yogurt?
Tristano says that could put a lot of smaller shops out of business. But not if Jessica Robinson has anything to do with it.
There's never going to be too many frozen yogurt places, in my opinion.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which I once again bow down to the greater wisdom of Twitter. I know I've said it before, but this time it actually comes with money attached. A couple of researchers at Indiana University did some analysis. 10 million tweets over an 8-month period back in 2008. They looked at those tweets for six characteristics: happiness, kindness, alertness, sureness, vitality, and calmness. Turns out they can tell within a window of 2 to 6 days whether the Dow was going to go up or going to go down. There is more to it than I can tell you in 25 seconds, of course. The link to the research is on our website. It's marketplace.org. If you're looking for me on Twitter, by the way, it's at Kai Rizdahl. We are at Marketplace Radio. And for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 129 points, more than 1%. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about 0.8%. The S&P 500 up 12 points, just over 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, a punk rocker turned stay-at-home mom and the frustrations of Portland, Oregon's unemployed.
To suddenly be this generation and to have had children and to have those jobs just go away, I think it's been a shock.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.